This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
All right, just try and relax your arm there. Little poke. All right, that's it, okay?
The sound of a COVID-19 vaccine going into a Californian arm. By now, about 10 million people across California have been fully vaccinated, and millions more are waiting in line. And yet, many others are saying, no thanks. Who are they? A few weeks ago, the Public Policy Institute of California conducted a survey to find out. And when analyst Rachel Lawler and her colleagues sliced and diced the results, the biggest group of vaccine resistors they found in California were Republicans. More than a third said they probably won't get vaccinated.
It's still about 4 in 10 Republicans saying they are unlikely to be vaccinated compared to only 10% of Democrats and 19% of independents.
So why the Republican reluctance? Reporter Jackie Sedley talked to lots of local Republicans, and she has some answers.
First off, let's be clear about the polling. A majority of California Republicans are willing to get vaccinated. One-third said in that survey that they're unlikely, but that means two-thirds are good to go. And many already have.
Mainstream Republicans, and I like to call myself one of those and be fairly in tune with that group of people in Orange County, they're getting the vaccine, they're on board with the vaccine.
That's Alex Eisner, an attorney in Orange County who is happy to get vaxxed. And here's fellow Republican and the Huntington Beach City Council member Mike Posey.
Well, it sounds like I've been the majority. Because, the majority says that they will get the vaccine, and there's a large minority that says that they won't.
Both say they haven't noticed any correlation between being vaccine hesitant and being Republican. In fact, Eisner credits the Trump administration for the vaccine rollout's success.
I don't see or know of any hardcore Trump holdouts who think that the former president wouldn't have wanted them to get it, because he was kind of the champion of it while he was president, because it was his baby. And I know a good number of those Trump holdouts, many of whom I know have gotten vaccinated.
Getting vaccinated is one thing, but expecting others to do the same is where some Republicans draw the line. Here's Posey again.
I think that if there was a mandate to get the vaccine, I probably wouldn't get it just because of that. But I got the vaccine, through free will and free choice. I didn't do it because I was expectant that there would be a vaccine mandate or a vaccine passport or any of those kinds of draconian rules, because I'm not necessarily one to follow lockstep with those kinds of rules, especially being a Republican.
A quick side note. There aren't any vaccine mandates on the horizon right now, nor any vaccine passports, which would essentially be digital proof of vaccination used to gain entry somewhere. Also, the White House has said it won't be imposing any mandates, though some colleges are saying they'll require vaccination to enroll in person. Okay, back to Posey. He compares vaccine mandates to state laws that require motorcyclists like himself to wear helmets while riding, as an infringement on personal freedom and privacy.
I always wear a helmet. I'll always wear a helmet. A helmet is a smart idea. It's dumb to not wear a helmet. But why would the government demand that I protect myself from my own stupidity and force me to wear a helmet? And the vaccine mandate is the same thing.
Now, there are, of course, real-world consequences to other people if one makes a personal decision not to get vaccinated. Remember the 2015 Disneyland measles outbreak? Unvaccinated kids left 131 Californians infected. So even without an actual vaccine mandate, the idea of a mandate upset many Republicans, even the ones who already got the shot. And then there's those who are not so willing to face the needle. Eric Peterson is a self-identified conservative Republican, and he sits alongside Posey on Huntington Beach City Council. He isn't against anyone getting this vaccine, his wife has, but he doesn't feel he needs it.
I'm not afraid of it. I just don't want to get it. I don't like putting extra things in my body that I don't think I need. And I think it's my choice. I don't get the flu shot every year. I don't get anything that I don't need to get. I take my vitamins and I try to eat healthy. That's it.
Peterson notes a divide between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to the handling of the pandemic. Here's how he sees it.
Where do they lie? Republicans want personal choice and personal responsibility and open things up. And the Democrats seem to want do what we say, whether it be masks, vaccine, or whatever, and then we'll let you have your freedoms back.
But whether or not the issue is actually partisan, Peterson's take on the whole pandemic is making one Democrat in particular very uneasy. Dan Kalnick, a council member occupying the seat right next to Peterson on Huntington Beach City Council.
You know, I have a 2-year-old and I sit between two folks on council that won't wear masks. And so if they're asymptomatic and not getting vaccinated, I've got that 5% chance that I could still get contagious and then I could give it to my daughter, who could end up with, I think it's what Kawasaki is, the inflammation disease. And like, I don't want to put my daughter at risk for that because I got two people that think they know better than science.
Kalnick says he's frustrated that the whole thing is being made into a political issue instead of a public health issue.
I look at it as we've got mandates for public health across the board that we've all accepted. Why is this one any different? And it's not a good faith argument for those saying it's different.
And then you have Republicans who don't want the vaccine because they don't trust it. Brenna Makauka has never been a fan of vaccines and is especially ignoring calls to get one for COVID-19. She had always voted Democrat until Trump came into office. Then she switched to Republican. Makauka attended several pro-Trump rallies during the pandemic and an anti-vax protest at Dodger Stadium back in January.
There's something about this vaccine that is going awry, and I don't like it. And I can smell it. I can sense it. I'm highly intuitive. Something's not right.
Makauka, though, is somewhat of an outlier. Here's how OC Republican Alex Eisner sums up what he's seen.
There are various amounts of skepticism, certainly about the vaccine, the speed with which it was created, and the rigor with which the FDA approval process was undergone. But it didn't seem to stop any of the ones that I know from going ahead and getting it.
Even with some anti-vaxxers still in the mix, Rachel Lawler with the Public Policy Institute says the group's polling indicates vaccine skepticism is declining.
Those that say they will definitely get the vaccine are increasing, and we're seeing that increasing among pretty much every group, even among Republicans. So if the goal is herd immunity, then that's positive, even if it's, you know, small incremental steps.
One certainty with COVID-19, when the virus infects, it doesn't distinguish between Democrats and Republicans. For KCRW, I'm Jackie Sedley.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Last week, U.S. District Judge David O. Carter ordered the city of LA to offer shelter to people experiencing homelessness on Skid Row. On Sunday, he agreed to put a pause on the part of that order that would have required the city to put $1 billion, billion with a B, in escrow to pay for it. Well, the city and county of L.A. have both filed appeals in the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, so the future of the ruling actually hangs in the balance. Here to unspool the legalese is Gary Blasey. He's a professor emeritus of law at UCLA. He's a public interest lawyer and an advocate as well. Gary, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
It's a 110-page ruling. It quotes Brown v. Board of Education. It quotes Abraham Lincoln. What do you think of Judge Carter's ruling?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, and you can take that in multiple different ways.
Extraordinary means extraordinary. So what makes this so out of the ordinary?
Well, it's really the first real order that the judge has issued beyond what he has done with respect to homeless people under freeways, and it comes despite the fact that there hasn't been a trial or any evidence, really. Judge Carter has sort of created his own procedure for gathering evidence, and in fact, he issued this order before he read the opposition to the request for the order, because it was issued within hours of the deadline for filing of the briefs of the city, the county, and the interveners.
I would imagine Judge Carter would say the evidence that he has is just you know, what's before his eyes.
That's true, but there's a lot that you can't see, especially if you go to Skid Row. You can see a lot of horrible things, and you don't necessarily spend your time everywhere else, and including the places that populate Skid Row. And people don't aren't born on Skid Row; they come there from other places.
This ruling, as I mentioned, it's a long ruling. It mentions a lot of historical things as well. Is it unusual, Gary? I mean, some people are calling it judicial overreach. Do you see that in this ruling, or is this just, you know, this guy is frustrated? He's obviously dealt with this issue on many occasions in different places, and that he's, you know, he really wants to make a mark on this issue.
Well, for sure, the frustration is understandable. Whether it's overreach or not, it's certainly a form of judicial activism. And again, some people think that's good. Some people think it's less good, usually organized around the sort of left and right conservative liberal. But he's gone much further than judges ordinarily do. Judges have a lot of power to tell people what they can't do, tell local government what they can do. It's very unusual, especially in the very beginning of a case, for a judge to tell local authorities what they must do, what priorities they must have, and what money they must spend, and basically substitute the court's judgment for the decisions of elected officials.
I mean, obviously, the United States Constitution includes separation of powers, right? Who is the powerful here? Who has the power here?
Well, in the particular arena where the judge is intervening, most of the courts that have looked at this have deferred to local officials, unless they were doing something that was particularly egregious and wrong, in which case they can stop something. And eventually, in, for example, the prison reform healthcare cases, they can get more involved. But that's usually after a lot of process and after the parties have had plenty of time to do what they should do to accomplish a result. So the judge could order them to get to a result, but he can't really do all the kinds of things that he's asked them to do in particular to get there.
The city and county are appealing this ruling. What grounds have they filed their appeal on? I mean, do you think they have a good case?
Based on kinds of things that I was just talking about in terms of the ability of courts to intrude into areas that are really involve balancing where to spend money and where to operate, where to prioritize. I don't think there's any way that the appellate court will not stay this order if asked to, and the order would not survive on appeal, in my opinion.
Some housing advocates, Gary, are concerned that the judge's ruling relies too heavily on finding and offering shelter, but they're not permanent solutions by any stretch. And you mentioned it could be a parking lot with tents, as we talked about on this program yesterday. Seeing as the order came out on a lawsuit brought by business owners and landlords, part of this group, LA Human Rights Alliance, as an advocate yourself, as an attorney, how do you see this? I mean, considering where it came from?
Well, regardless of where it came from, it would set back our thinking and our policy in this area by about the 30 years that I've been involved.
That's a long time.
Well, I was once one of the people who thought the answer to homelessness was shelter, because that's what you do when people lose their housing in a disaster. But it turns out what happens if you create shelter is one of two things. One is the shelters immediately become full, and people are then still left on the street, or the shelters are so bad that people will not go into them in the first place, and they're still on the street. The only solution to houselessness or homelessness is some sort of at least minimal actual housing, where you have some privacy, some permanence, some ability to have pets, relationships, and a little bit of an ordinary life.
How do you do that, though, when you've got 60, 70,000 people on the streets at any given time, and it's just, it seems like it's just overwhelming.
Well, it is overwhelming, and it's been growing at least over those last 30 years that I mentioned. Can't be solved overnight, but it can be made worse overnight, which in my view the judge's order would do. The other thing to consider is that it's not cheaper to shelter people. As you all reported yesterday about the cost of a 12 by 12 painted square on
$2,600,
asphalt.
Yeah.
$2,600 for that. And in general, well, $2,600 will rent you
per month, by the way. Per month, yeah.
Yes, per month, yeah, exactly. And that's generally true that the cost of shelter once the all the bureaucracy and the oversight and the security and all that is included, it's more expensive than housing. So it just doesn't make sense as a long-term solution. I mean, it does make sense to keep people alive and to have a place where they can go in the rainy season and that sort of thing, but we shouldn't think that we can just provide overnight shelter without anything else, which would mean that people would move from one place to another. Which is another aspect of focusing on Skid Row. Only 7% of the unsheltered homeless in the city of LA live in Skid Row. And so doing something in Skid Row does not solve the problem, even in Skid Row. For example, if the shelter offered in Skid Row was better than an encampment, people would go to Skid Row to get that better thing. People are not... are mobile to at least to some extent. So it just wouldn't solve the problem. Hopefully we'll get back to trying to work on real solutions.
Gary Blasey, Professor Emeritus of Law over at UCLA. Gary, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The city of LA has received way less than half of its average rainfall this wet season, with a typically very dry summer on the way. Severe, extreme, or exceptional drought now encompasses the vast majority of California.
In a 144-year record, this is going to be the sixth driest year. 16 of the last 22 years have been below average, and so we're in a 22-year drought.
That's climatologist Bill Patzert, by the way. Droughts, melting ice caps, rising ocean levels, bigger and more frequent storms, mass migration away from uninhabitable places on planet Earth. Climate change is a frightening concept with giant implications. Hard to even get your mind around, right? Well, a new podcast series is trying to wrangle those concepts and connect them to what's happening in your own piece of the world. In Our Backyard is a series hosted by longtime journalist and KCRW's own Warren Olney. And Warren is here to tell us more. Hey there, Warren.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. I feel like it's been forever since we've had you on this program. You've spent a lot of time digging into climate change. It's got to be, I guess, kind of terrifying to have to think about and to research and to report on day after day. What's that process been like for you?
Well, it can be terrifying. There's no question about it. And the premise of the podcast is In Your Backyard. It's here for all of the reasons that you suggested and others as well. But the way we're looking at it is this, that we can't prevent climate change, but we can prevent it from being worse than it needs to be. And so what we've done is take a look at the areas in this area, Southern California in general, where drought, for example, such as we heard from Bill Pastert, is now with us. Sea level rise is with us. Of course, we have the wildfires. And the idea is, what can we do to mitigate these things? How can we adapt in the interests of those who are going to have to deal with this a lot more than we are? So it's a matter of looking toward the future.
We've heard a lot of these things, Warren, for years now with all the bad news about climate change. Has anything new and, I don't know, anything surprising come up while you've been working on this podcast? Something that you were like, oh, okay.
I wouldn't call it surprising so much as I would inspiring. What I have found, particularly among young people that I didn't expect to, is a sense that, okay, we're going to have to deal with this, and so let's figure out how to do it. One person that really springs to mind is a young woman who's now in college, who was evacuated from wildfire for the first time when she was 8. And so she understands about as well as anybody I can think of what is already with us and what is likely to come. And her attitude toward it is that this is something we're going to have to deal with, and it's her responsibility, as it is, I think, yours and mine, to try to figure ways of making it not be so bad. And when you listen to her talk about it and what she has in mind, it's, as I say, it's really inspiring.
You're calling the podcast In Our Backyard. Our backyard, obviously, is the Pacific Ocean. We know sea levels are rising. What are the implications for our backyard with sea levels rising and that big pond just to the west?
Well, the backyard we're looking at is much broader than just the ocean. It includes the deserts and the forests and the metropolitan areas as well. But as far as the ocean is concerned, sea levels are rising. So what we're facing is the loss of all the beaches in California. There's a scientific study that says, I think it's 1,800 miles worth of beaches, are going to be gone in 80 years if we don't shape up. And so one of the things we look at is the ways in which we have tried to prevent the coast from moving by building docks, you know, breakwaters and all of that kind of thing. When in fact, if you leave the coast to its natural condition, it moves. It moves all the time. And the way to deal with it, consequently, is to pull back, to let it move, to not try to alter it. It's very interestingly a concept that was very much part of Native American culture, which we abolished in California for a long time, but which we're beginning to look at again.
Well, you actually spend a good deal of time talking about local Native American history and culture. I want to hear from Lorene Sisquak. She's on your program, of the Mountain Kaweah and Fort Sill Apache Band.
We were different in that most everything that we used was made out of plants. From our homes, our tools, our soap, our weapons, clothing, of course, medicines and foods and, you know, that, but also the baskets and utilitarian things. Just about everything was made out of plants.
So, you know, working off the land, right? I mean, why'd you decide to talk to local Native Americans? Well, I mean, what's the connection to climate change?
Well, it's quite fascinating. What happened when the Europeans arrived is that they had a different view of nature than the Native Americans, who had been here for 12,000 years and been quite successful at it, by considering nature as a part of themselves and themselves as part of nature. So that they worked with the environment rather than trying to overcome the environment. We come from the tradition that says that the environment is here for us to either preserve or do with as we will. And what we have done is destroy it in a lot of different ways. So we talk about that and how what's happening, for example, at the Sherman Indian High School, which is where the woman we just heard from is now in charge. The Sherman Indian High School was originally designed to teach Indians, and I should say Native Americans, not to be Native Americans anymore. And they couldn't speak their language. They were there often against their will. And the idea was to get rid of that culture altogether. Now it is a sort of museum for that culture. And people are taking a look at it again with the idea that, yeah, we can't go back to what it was like before we got here, but we can begin to find ways of using those strategies and techniques that the Native Americans used to make things better than they have to be, than they might be.
If enough people, if enough folks jump on board, right? That's the thing.
Well, that's always the case. Sure, you start small and do the best you can. And I think we all have an obligation to try to learn as much as we possibly can, to try to adjust our lives as much as we possibly can. And one of the purposes of the series is to sort of slap people upside the head in that regard, because we've waited an awful long time to do it, and it's pretty late in the game.
Warren Olney, the host of the To The Point podcast, And now the new podcast series In Our Backyard. You can stream it, by the way, at kcrw.com. Warren, as always, great to have you on.
Thanks. Great to be on, and be well.
Slap people. That's a metaphor, by the way. So, inform. That's what we're trying to do. That's it for today. Tomorrow, you probably drive on it to head to LACMA or Beverly Hills, maybe DTLA, but there's plenty of history you may not know about Wilshire Boulevard and the man behind its name. Drop us a line at kcrw.com/greaterLA, and while you're there, subscribe to the podcast. Get every episode on the regular at kcrw.com. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Kat Yore, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordal. All had hands on today's show. All had hands on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears and your time. Have a great night.